W.B. West wrote a book a few years ago, I guess it's been longer than I think now, in which he referred to the book of Revelation as a project that we could undertake. First century glasses. And I think that that's good, but I also think it's optimistic on his part, especially when we look at a subject like we have tonight. One of the biggest prayers I prayed in preparing this lesson was that taking what I believe to be some of the more difficult material in the Bible and making it such that we can at least get some kind of a grasp on what John is talking about. That's the objective that we have this evening. That's General George Custer. He died in 1876 in the Battle of Little Bighorn. There was a man by the name of Bruce Brown who wrote a book a few years ago called Who Killed Custer? And there are so many enigmas and mysteries surrounding that battle. It was a unique part of the settlement of this entire country. It was an outgrowth of a manifest destiny policy that certainly had its good and its bad. But as he was in the battle, what he did was he took all the eyewitness accounts that were taken from that battle, and he came with what he called his three leading suspects as to who killed Custer. What I found remarkable about that was how conflicting they all were. That one of the theories, one of the leading suspects, was an Ogallala Sioux warrior who was said to have killed Custer near the very beginning of the battle. Other eyewitnesses looking at the same event said suspect number two was George Custer himself, that he committed suicide on his horse Victory near the end of the battle. And then there was a third suspect that several came up with, and it was actually shared at a 1909 Indian council. It was a Northern Cheyenne warrior who was said to have killed him in the middle of the battle. All the while, there was a secret oral history of the Southern Cheyenne Indians that said it was actually a woman who delivered the fatal blow. Buffalo Calf Trail Woman. I mention that to say that we're fascinated by battles, and we like mysteries, and the perplexity sometimes add to the mystique of that. I mentioned Brother West a moment ago. He said that the greatest battle in the annals of history took place between the Roman Empire, and the church. It was a battle that lasted 300 years, and the church emerged triumphant. I want you to keep that in mind as we get ready to look at our subject tonight. Brother West tells a story about a 4th century emperor by the name of Julian. And Julian, in his reign, decided to close all of what he called the churches of the Nazarenes and to reopen all of the idol temples that had been closed. And he was with his army on the way to fight the Persians, and he stopped in Antioch of Syria. He had a childhood friend there who had been converted to Christianity. And he wanted to go and gloat and to see him again. And as he stood in that man's shop, he observed to him about all the churches and how they were closed. And he said, "And how is the carpenter of Nazareth doing these days?" And the shopkeeper Christian replied boldly. He says, "He is building a coffin in which to bury your empire." About 2 years later, Julian lay on his bed dying, and he said, "You have conquered Galilean." Now, I want you to think about how in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, you have this picture for us, this idea of our being in a battle. We're in a fight. It is a fight at its most rudimentary level between God and Satan. It is between the faithful of God and the mindset, the value of this world. And so you'll find that terminology used all over the New Testament. You think about how Paul, a more seasoned preacher, is talking to a younger preacher, and he says to him, "I want you to fight the good fight of faith." You remember he says that in 1 Timothy 1:18, 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 12, 2 Timothy 2:3, 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7. And then he talks about this battle that we find ourselves in and how it's characterized. He says it's not a fleshly battle. It's not one that's fought with military might. It's one that's fought with the power of God, his stronghold, 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 4. That there are weapons of righteousness. That's what we use in this battle. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 7. And God has outfitted us with armor. He calls it the armor of light in Romans 13 and verse 12. And he calls it the armor of God in Romans Ephesians 6 verse 11 and verse 13. And he has given us weapons of righteousness. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 8. And I say all that to say that when we get to the book of Revelation and we see that there's this battle taking place, it's not a new idea. But it's an idea in which all three of our symbols, our pictures, our images are going to come from tonight. And so as we look at that, I want you to notice with me, I'm not going to go in the order that we have it here. I'm going to go in a little bit of a different order. But let me give you a little bit more background information before we get there. I want you to keep in mind that what John is writing about in the book of Revelation is something he says is about to take place soon. It's very important for us in studying the book of Revelation to see how he both begins the book and ends the book. In Revelation chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 3, and in Revelation chapter 22, verse 6 and verse 10, he says these are things that must soon come to pass. And so as we look at the 144,000, as we look at the mark of the beast, and as we look at the battle of Armageddon, I want you to keep in mind that while it's eternal truth that can have application for us, and that chapter 20 and verse 11 through chapter 22 and verse 21 concern events that have not yet occurred, that the bulk of this writing is about things that mattered to them, that they were going through, that needed to arm them so that they could be prepared and be victorious. You can keep that in mind. You also keep in mind that what we're looking at here is a certain kind of a literature. You often hear this being apocalyptic literature. The word apocalypsis means to lay bare. It means to make naked. And the way that he makes clear, overcomes is another sense of that word, but the way he lays it out for us is with symbols and with figures and with images. When you're reading the book of Revelation, you're seeing a series of pictures, and those pictures stand for something. What can happen is we get lost in the details and the weeds and the specifics. We're going to talk tomorrow about will Christ reign on the earth for 1,000 years, which seemed to me like a very easy topic until I looked at my text, Revelation 20, 1 through 6, and you have all of these pictures. And if we interpret the pictures, the symbols, inaccurately, we're going to get to some inaccurate conclusions. And that's what's happened. We've got these far-fetched ideas because we've not understood the pictures that John, by inspiration, is drawing out for us. And so as we look at all of these, I want you to think about the pictures that he's drawing for us. Okay, with that in mind, I'd like for us to look at those. And again, I'm going in a little bit different order, somewhat a biblical order as they appear in the book of Revelation. So if you want to turn in your Bibles over to Revelation chapter 7, that's where we first read about the 144,000. First time we encounter that is in Revelation chapter 7, verse 3 through 8. We will read some of our text, but I do have a clock in here, and I'm watching that. I want to manage my time well. I don't want to read that, but we'll refer to Revelation 7, 3 through 8. But let me get you up to speed as to where we are when we get to Revelation chapter 7. Revelation 1 through 3. If you've heard sermons and even Bible classes from the book of Revelation, it's more likely that you've heard more from 1 through 3 and 20 through 22, then you have all those chapters in between. And there's a reason for that. The 4 to 20 are full of those pictures, those symbols, those images. Chapters 1 through 3 are addressed to seven churches of Asia Minor. And in the writings in those three chapters, there are encouragements to them to be faithful. He points out the challenges that they have. Now you get to chapter 4 and 5, and what you have here is where the symbolism begins. And as you read the symbolism in chapter 4 and 5, two ideas you need to keep in your mind is that, number one, God is on the throne. That's what's being depicted. And not only is God on the throne, but God loves his children. That's really the overview of Revelation 4 and 5. Then you get to Revelation chapter 6. And what you have in Revelation chapter 6 are these seven seals. And what you need to remember is that Jesus has the authority, he has the power. A seal keeps something covered up in Revelation 6. And so he takes the lid off, and he is able, he is worthy to be able to show us what's in the contents. And so as he does, he is showing us about what the church was going to have to endure. For now, here's what you're going to have to go through. You need to be prepared for what's about to come. Now, when we get to chapter 7, we have Jesus again, John, referring to Christ, speaking words of comfort to the people of God again. And one of the ways he does that is by referring to the 144,000. You know, I thought that what we could do in this lesson is we could look at what some in dispensational premillennialism and our dear friends in the Jehovah's Witness group say about the 144,000, but I think what will serve us better is to go to Revelation 7, and in a moment we'll look at Revelation chapter 14 and see what we can say with certainty about the 144,000. All right, so let's look at a few of those things together. Number one, with regard to this 144,000, this is the number of those who are sealed. All right, so this idea of sealing is going to actually dovetail into our second point. Because here this idea of sealing is marking. It's the idea of identifying. This seal for identification is what is done by God for those who are His children. God is sealing, marking, demonstrating who belongs to Him. Now again, keep this in mind as you're thinking of the original recipients of this book. Here they are, feeling like nobodies in the Roman Empire, who are made to be nobodies, who are losing their lives, who are maybe despairing of hope. And what God is saying is, God has marked you out. He knows that you belong to Him. He sees that. As he looks down over all this empire, he sees the Christians and he sees that he's marked them. And this idea of sealing is an idea of what would happen when one is sealed by the blood of Christ and comes into Christ. The idea of sealing is not peculiar to Revelation. It's been spoken of in other passages. You might want to write this down. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 21 and 22, when we become a child of God, we are sealed by God's Spirit. Something similar is said in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 13 and 14, that you are sealed with the Spirit of promise. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 30, Paul says that we're not to despise the Spirit of God, whereby we were sealed unto the day of redemption. But a passage that seems a lot like how John is using it in Revelation is Paul's words in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 19, where he says that we have the foundation of God, which is sure, having this seal. God knows the ones that belong to Him. So as we look at this 144,000, here's what we can know for sure. This is the number of those who were sealed. Now John is going to mention this again in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 1. He says, I looked and beheld, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with Him the 144,000, having His name and the name of His Father on their forehead. All right, so we're going to talk about the mark of the beast, and they're going to have a mark. God's people have a mark. Now, we're going to say this in greater detail in just a moment. The mark, this seal, is not an actual seal. It's something that God sees and that God knows. And so as we think about that seal, that's what we know, number one. Number two, we know that they were from every tribe of the sons of Israel. That's chapter 7, verse 3, verse through verse 8. Now, how do we know this is figurative? I suggest to you, let me make the claim, this is figurative. So how do we know? Well, if we look very closely at that list of the tribes of Israel, do you notice something about it? Doesn't look like the ones we find in the Old Testament, does it? You don't have Dan and you don't have Ephraim. And so something's going on here, and there's been some suggestions, and I won't take the time to share that, about why those tribes are left out. It doesn't matter. John's not trying to give us something about physical Israel. It's not about it at all. But not only that, Judah is mentioned first. In no Old Testament listing of the tribes would you find Judah first. It doesn't make sense. You would start with Reuben, more logically. Maybe Judah, because Jesus is from the tribe of Judah. The idea is, this is not physical Israel. This is a picture. This is a picture of spiritual Israel. And what is spiritual Israel? It's the church. And so John is painting a picture for us when he describes the tribes of the sons of Israel, this 144,000, they are spiritual Israel, the church. That helps us. That's an important clue in understanding the 144,000. We know that this is figurative because it utilizes numerology. I've heard it said the book of Revelation is kind of the greatest hits of the Bible, where you go through in those first 65 books, there's a lot of Old Testament literature and references with New Testament application. Numerology is something that especially meant something to the Jews. If we think about numbers in the book of Revelation, the one we usually think of is what? What is the number you usually think of significance? Seven. What does seven stand for? It's perfect, right? That's what's perfection. Now, when you look at that number, 144,000, it also plays on two numbers in numerology of significance. Anybody want to guess what those are? 12. Okay, 12, if we've got 12, the other one's 10. All right, so you think about what those numbers mean. Let's deal with 12 first. What's the number 12? Well, the number 12 is the number for God's government. It's also the number of God's people. There are 12 tribes of Israel. There are 12 apostles. And so I want you to see that 12 times that 12, God's Old Testament people, God's New Testament people. And what about that number 10? 10 is also a number for completion. But what's 1,000? 10 times 10 times 10. When the Bible uses 3 and it triples down, it's saying absolutely complete. So who are the 144,000? It is all of God's redeemed of the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's all of God's faithful. And so what John is saying is, by referencing these who are sealed, who belong to God, is that all Christians, all the redeemed, are precious to Him. And He sees them in that way. Now, in chapter 14, what time are we done, David? 10 till?
Take your time.
Okay, well, I want to get through. Let's go to chapter 14 for just a moment. I want us to read that. Take the time to read it. I hope that when we're done with this point, that you will be convicted that this 144,000 cannot, absolutely cannot be literal. It must be figurative, and if it's figurative, what it stands for. All right, so Revelation 14 in verse 1, hopefully you're there with me. It says, "Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him the 144,000, which I heard was," "having the name and the name of his Father on their foreheads. And I heard the voice from heaven, like the sound of many waters, and like the peals of loud thunder. And the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who had not been defiled with women, for they had kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever He goes. These have been purchased from among men as the first fruits of God and to the Lamb. And no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless." Now these are the same 144,000 that we read about in Revelation chapter 7. They're singing the song of victory, the song of the Lamb, the new song. Now, if this 144,000 were literal, we've got at least four problems. If the 144,000 are literal, do you know who's not going to be in heaven? Women. Why are women not going to be in heaven? Because these are men who have not defiled themselves with women. That means we lose Mary, we lose Hannah, we lose Dorcas, we lose a whole lot more. But not only that, if this number is literal, you know who else is not going to be in heaven? Married men. Why not married men? Because this is those who have not defiled themselves with women, who are chaste. These are virgins. And so that causes us to lose some others, right? Peter, who we know is a married man. We have Abraham. We have Moses, we have so many others, all the other apostles outside of Paul. So we know it's not literal. But if this were literal, not only that, but we also see that there would be nobody from Dan or Ephraim. Well, what's the big deal? There goes Joshua the conqueror. There goes Samson, who is in Faith's Hall of Fame. If this number is literal and not figurative, then there goes the Gentiles. Somebody said that, there goes us. Because these are those who are numbered among those 12 tribes of Israel, if that's to be taken literally. But Jesus says in Matthew 8 and verse 11 that they will come from the east and the west, and they will sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. And so we are confirmed in our conviction that this is not about a set number. By the way, what are the chances if there's 144,000, 12,000 from each tribe, that exactly 12,000 from each tribe are blameless? And so we look back and we get an accurate view of the picture. God is saying that He has set His seal on His redeemed people, that no matter how things are going in the time in which we live, and they live in a uniquely difficult time, facing uniquely difficult challenges that we might someday face, we don't presently face, but God sees them and will not forget them, and they will be victorious ultimately. That's the 144,000. More we can say about that. We need to move on. By the way, let me just say this. You might want to notice this same group as those that are spoken of in Revelation 7, 9 through 17. He says, after this, I looked and beheld a great number which no one could count, of every tongue and tribes and peoples and languages. And they're before the throne. They sing the song of Moses and the Lamb. They don't hunger anymore. They don't thirst anymore. Neither does the sun light on them or any heat. For the Lamb that's in the midst of the throne shall feed them and lead them to living fountains of water. And God shall wipe away all their tears. So we find all of the redeemed. We find great encouragement for us today as we live faithfully that God sees us among all the people on this earth as His special people. But then number two, we have the mark of the beast. All right, so we go in a little bit different direction. But I do want to tie you back to that first point. God sealed His own. We have here the idea of the mark of the beast, where the beast marks those that belong to him too. Now, that word seal is a little bit different word from the word mark. The word seal means to put a mark on. It means to indicate ownership. It means a use of identification. But the word mark means an engraving, a branding, an identification, a stamping. It was used in the Roman Empire of everything from money to slaves. But it's an indelible mark. They're closely related. And I think John is making a contrast with that. John introduces the idea of the mark of the beast in Revelation chapter 13. So if you look over there in Revelation chapter 13, in verse 16 is where he begins. And John is going to talk in great length about this mark of the beast in chapter 13 and 14. And something you need to understand as you read the book of Revelation is some books you read like a thread all the way through. You start in it and it goes in one long line. I've heard Revelation described as it kind of a lurching as you go forward. He goes forward, he comes back, he goes forward until he reaches that climax. One climax in chapter 19, another climax in chapter 20, and the final climax in chapter 22. But we have him introducing the concept here, and he's going to come back to it later on in the book of Revelation. And doing that, we could spend hours talking about some of the theories that our brethren have deduced with regard to the mark of the beast. Days, if we open it up to all the religious ideas. But I feel like the safe ground that we can stand on is, let's summarize what we know without a doubt. And I'm going to give you five things with regard to the mark of the beast in Revelation chapter 13. Number one, this mark was required by the earth beast. You're going, okay, Neil, what does that mean? Well, that's in chapter 13, verse 15 and 16. In chapter 12, in chapter 13, we have three entities that John is talking about. The first is that fourfold description of the devil in chapter 12 and verse 9. And so that dragon, that Satan and devil, that serpent of old, that's the devil. Okay, so he's discussed in chapter 12. We have the sea beast and the earth beast. And really, if you'll read it, it really helps you to understand this is the case. You don't have to draw a lot of deductions. The sea beast deals with the civil authority of Rome. And then the earth beast deals with the religious authority of Rome. Okay, so those last two, there's some interplay. Because when you go afoul of the civil authorities of Rome, there's a cost the Christians are going to have to pay. When you go afoul of the religious authority in Rome, there was a price to pay, an even worse price to pay. What's the religious authority? Well, there is the impressing or the mandating of emperor worship. It's going to be mandated throughout the time of the Roman Empire. And if the Christians are found not worshiping the emperor, they could lose their life. And that's something John's going to tell us here in just a moment. And so in Revelation chapter 13, verse 15 and 16, we're focusing in on emperor worship. Some have suggested that this mark, this stamp, was literal. Barclay, for one, says that there appears to have been a certificate. So there were various minor officials in the Roman Empire, and they went around and they saw the tradesmen, the guildsmen, the ones in various occupations. And what they would do is they would notice, and if you paid obeisance, if you worshiped the emperor, then they would write you a certificate. And you could take that, and as you did business, and they would ask, well, have you worshiped the emperor? They'd say, here it is. That's a possibility. I'm inclined to believe that it's figurative rather than literal because of that seal. And it seems that John is using those in that way. It's okay if you don't agree with that, but I think it to be that way. And what was more likely was that as these Christians went about, you could tell in society those who bore the imprint in their character and conduct that they were submissive to this decree of the Romans. But when you looked at the Christians, you could see from their character and their conduct just as equally that there was something different about them. And so maybe what happens is that words getting around in the community, you see, that's a Christian. And I know that the Christian has convictions and it's not going to bow to the emperor. And so this mark was required by the earth beast. And number two, we can know that this was a universal requirement. Nobody was exempt. You were rich, you were poor. You were old, you were young. You were bond, you were free. You had to participate in that. A third and a rather tragic thing is that without this mark, that the child of God would be killed. Because it was the Christians who refused to do this. Of all the different people that were brought together in the Roman Empire, it was Christians that had the conviction to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to do this. Now, not only would they be killed, but they would also pay a huge financial price. The idea is that there were some, and we're going to look at this tomorrow in chapter 20, is that you had some who were beheaded because of their testimony, because of the word of God, and there were others who paid a price, but maybe not so severe, in their bold declaration of Christ. Some were killed, some were not. A great many were. But if you were found not to, for in whatever way it was, if it was a certificate, if it was a literal sign, or if it was reputation, that there were Christians by the scores that lost their lives. Because there was Nero, there was Domitian, there was Caligula, and there were others who came around with this same idea, trying to defeat the Christians. But then the number of this mark was 666, chapter 13 and verse 18. Now, here's another use of numerology. You guys seem to be well apprised of numerology. What's the number six? Anybody know?
One less than perfect.
One less than perfect. So what's the idea of one less than perfect? Forever incomplete. It's also the number for man. And so this mark is an indication of hope for these Christians who are losing their lives for not bowing down to the emperor. They bear this mark of the beast is 666. Complete, totally inadequate, cannot do what God, the devil is trying to do with the Roman Empire. It's not going to destroy Christianity. An awesome truth is that the devil tried to destroy the Christ child, Revelation says, and he failed. He tried to destroy the church as a whole, and he failed. He can still get individual congregations. He can still get individual Christians, but he can't get the church. And so this mark shows them, you're not going to be successful. And then the fifth thing that we can know is that the ones who had the mark of the beast faced divine wrath. So you have this contrast in chapter 14, where the ones who had that mark, the ones who were inadequate, who were doomed to fail for aligning with the empire and not aligning with Christ, they faced the wrath of God, which was going to be poured out without mixture, and the smoke of their torment will ascend up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night that worship the beast and his image and the mark of his name. What about the Christians? Verse 13, blessed are the dead that die in the Lord from henceforth. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their work do follow them. I mean, we're talking about some of the darkest things that our brothers and sisters in Christ, with whom we hope to share eternity, ever faced in the history of the church. And in this deepest valley, you have John, through inspiration, giving them hope as they looked ahead. Well, let's spend a little time in that last point about the Battle of Armageddon. You know, whenever we're looking at symbols in figurative languages, there's two things that we want to avoid. Number one, we want to avoid an interpretation that would be meaningless to the original readership. I want you to especially keep that in mind in the Battle of Armageddon. Because when we hear about Armageddon, we're thinking about some latter-day thing that's supposed to happen. And you have to ask yourself, these Christians who are suffering, will I live or will I die today? What did they care about some person that would be identified way out in the future as the precipitator or the cause of some end-of-the-world battle? But not only that, we want to be careful about any interpretation that comes into conflict with other clearer texts on the subject. This is highly figurative in Revelation chapter 20. You know, so many today speak of Armageddon as this unprecedented holocaust, this literal battle that's going to take place on earth between Christ and Satan, and that when Jesus wins this battle, he's going to reign on earth for 1,000 years, and at the end of that, there's going to be a final judgment. And while some have drawn such conclusions, John paints an altogether different picture for us. Armageddon, as you can see there, simply means the hill of Megiddo. Now, it is a place that's renowned throughout history as being a place where battles repeatedly took place. And let me tell you why. The Valley of Jezreel, in which Megiddo is situated, is 15 miles east of the Mediterranean Sea. It is a major land bridge that joins two perpetually world empires. You have Egypt to the south, and you have Mesopotamia to the north. They're hemmed in with a desert on the east side and the Mediterranean on the west side. It was the quickest way to get through Israel. And so it was very strategic. It was strategic for two groups of people. It was strategic for those with commercial interests who were carrying their goods over this very major highway. And it was of military significance because Megiddo was a place, if you controlled it, where you could win the battle. And when people lose, and by the way, that's the reason why there have been 34 major bloody conflicts in 4,000 years there. We think about the Middle East and how often it's contested. It's been that way for millennia. And so John is referring to this place where battle occurs. And in Scripture, in Megiddo, when one loses, it is associated with death and devastation, and victory and control is what's associated with those who win. So what John is doing here is he is depicting this battle that's going to take place between Christ and Satan that's taking place at a place of bloody conflict. In Revelation chapter 16, we're heading toward the end of John's message. And in Revelation 19, 11 through 21, John is going to picture this, I almost said this battle occurring. Satan and his forces are arrayed for battle. But one thing I want you to catch is there is no battle of Armageddon. No battle takes place. And we'll see more about that in just a moment. But it's very important to see that John frequently in Revelation uses places, cities, to picture concepts, right? Jerusalem and Zion are used to represent the spiritual city, the church. All right, so Babylon is used in Revelation 14 and verse 8 to represent those who are opposed to God. Sodom is used, and Egypt is used to, in Revelation 11 and verse 8, to picture wickedness. It's just like the word, our word for hell in the New Testament is Gehenna. Gehenna is using a picture of a place. It's the trash dump in the Valley of Hinnom, right outside of the city of Jerusalem, where a fire is kept burning perpetually. It's the word that was used by the Greeks, or that Greek word that was used for hell. Armageddon pictures battle, and that's what John is doing here. Now, frequently, in the battles that took place in the Valley of Jezreel in Megiddo, God's people actually had the smaller, weaker force. And I don't know that that's insignificant. You think about how Deborah and Barak, they go against the Canaanites and they have this smaller force, and Sisera has his 900 chariots and God's people win. Or you look at Gideon against the Midianites, and God whittles down his forces to 300 so that God can demonstrate he's the one winning the battle, and so you have this smaller force. And even with Josiah, you remember when Josiah foolishly, the most righteous king that Judah had in the divided kingdom, he goes and he fights Pharaoh Necho. He's warned not to do that because he is going to lose his life, and yet he engages Pharaoh Necho long enough that the Pharaoh cannot go and join the Assyrians, and as the result of that, Babylon becomes the world power. God accomplishes what he sets out to do in the battle. And if you're these Christians and you're reading this, you're thinking we're the smaller force. Hey, can we make application of that today? Do we find ourselves the smaller force? Do we feel like our number is insignificant? What impact can we make on this world? And why can't it be like the glory days of the church in the first century? This is the first century, and this is what they faced. And yet, God is saying there's a battle going on, and we're going to win. And all that you read in Revelation that you might not understand, you need to understand that's the bottom line of this, is that in the end, we're going to be on the winning side. And they needed to know this particularly as they fought. In Revelation 16 through 19, it's important for us to see that there is no battle. Donald Guthrie says, there is no description of any battle. The warrior king conquers not through military power, but through the sword proceeding from his mouth. His devastating command is enough. Christ needs no armies. He needs no help from us. The one who spoke everything into existence is going to be the one who speaks everything out of existence. And so there is no ramp up for this Armageddon in which the forces of good and evil are going to fight each other on earth, because it's not a fair fight. Christ is going to devour it all with the sword of his mouth. No battle is necessary. You know, those who fear a doomsday Armageddon, some nuclear war, some biological war that's going to bring everything to an end, it's a misplaced fear. Our greatest fear ought to be not being on the Lord's side in this battle. Our greatest fear should be failing to get ready for Christ's second coming, the day of the Lord. But if we're faithful children of God, we already know how it's going to be. In 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4, John says, for whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. Now these are controversial and figurative symbols that have gotten so many people confused, but I believe that there's an underlying truth that ties all of them together. And here's what I think that it is. Number one, the Lord knows those who are his redeemed. He seals us with the blood of Christ. When we come out of the waters of baptism, when we become his children, he sees us, he knows us. He marks us in that way. Number two, the Lord knows those who serve and follow the God of this world. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4. And someday he's going to pour out his wrath on those who chose the world over his son. And number three, the Lord knows when he will end it all, and he knows how he will end it all. He is going to gather out of the world those who are his own, and they're going to live with him forever. That's what he's helping us to see in Revelation 21 and 22. And those who refuse to come out of the world, they're going to share the fate that originally was only determined for the devil and his angels. Revelation chapter 20, verse 11 through 15. But God leaves that choice in our hands. We get to decide who our commander-in-chief is going to be. The book of Revelation makes the choice as simple as possible. We get to choose the winning side, or we get to choose the losing side. And God determines who the winners and who the losers are going to be, and not the world. And we can't judge it by what we can see right now, because the end comes at the end, and that's when victory will occur. Now that's what they heard, I believe, with great conviction. When John was giving them that number of the 144,000, the redeemed of all the ages who were marked out by him as his own. And this mark of the beast were, in the Roman Empire, those who acquiesced and conformed to this world. They were not transformed by the renewing of their mind. And the Christians said, we'll choose death over bowing to that. And then that battle of Armageddon is a picture of hope and victory, because God is saying the battle is already won. You stay on my side and you'll see that it's the case, because it's not a battle at all. No one can stand against me. And that helped them. And I truly believe It'll help us today. We've got about 5 minutes left. I don't know if we want to answer any questions. I don't know if I can answer your questions if you have them. And I don't have much voice left tonight, but if there is a question you feel like we haven't answered on those three, we'll both take the risk. Yes, sir.
How many resurrections are there?
I'm going to talk about that tomorrow. Easy enough. I like that question. I want another question like that. No, but I will. I will deal with that tomorrow. Not that you had, don't, please don't feel like you need to watch it, but, huh?
It's a cliffhanger.
It's a cliffhanger. That's right. You can watch it on YouTube or be here in person. Anything else? The reason I say that is because my text tomorrow is going to be Revelation 20, 1 through 6. And the first resurrection's dealt with there. And I believe I can pretty confidently give you some answers to that. All right. Well, let's bow for a word of prayer and then we'll be dismissed.